From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in an interview in 2007 in The Nation magazine. Journalist Tomas Palermo wanted readers to understand the influence of an education professor named Jamal Cooks. Cooks, as Palermo explained, teaches teachers how to teach. He helps teachers understand how to reach young people, how to connect, how to break down barriers. And introducing the interview, Palermo wrote this about Cooks, quote, "Teachers frequently encounter him on panels with titles like The Expanding Canon, Teaching Multicultural Literature in High School. But the dude is also hella down to earth. He was in some pretty successful true school era hip-hop recording groups and currently coaches high school track at Oakland's Skyline High School, a frequent California State track meet qualifier. Meet the man who made it his passion to change the public education game, one class at a time." End quote. Now, did part of that paragraph stand out to you? Palermo writes that Cooks is a dude who is, quote, hella down to earth. And maybe to your ear, that sounds like a guy, the author, trying too hard, straying from what you perceive as traditional English. But in a book titled Other People's English, the authors argue it's something else. It's not code switching, which you've probably heard discussed on NPR and elsewhere. The authors say it's code meshing. So what is code meshing? Well, the authors argue that American classrooms, newsrooms, and places of employment are staffed by people who largely overvalue their own view of so-called traditional English, causing harm to students and citizens who use African-American English. And this afternoon, Nazareth College is welcoming Dr. Vershawn Ashanti Young, known as Dr. Vay, and Wyshonda Young Rivera. They are the co-authors of Other People's English. But first, they are our guests right here on Connections. And thank you both for being here. It's great to have both of you here. Thank you.
Thank you
for having us.
We have a lot of different directions we can go. I'll tell our listeners, if you've got questions or comments as we talk about so-called traditional English, as we talk about code switching, code meshing, the differences, how to understand that, the views of our guests, you can call the program. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Now, tonight at 5:30 at the Nazareth College Art Center, they're going to be presenting Code Meshing, Critical Awareness in Action. And I will ask you both, starting with Wyshonda, what you want audiences to hear tonight at 5:30.
Tonight we want them to hear that code meshing is larger than just code meshing, thus our critical awareness in action. In this era where we talk about being woke, when we are aware of things going on concerning racial and social justice issues, code meshing is the platform through which that happens in the classroom. So it's being woke, being critically aware, but that's not enough. What do we do in response?
Okay. Dr. Vay?
Same thing. I will add, though, that people who come to the lecture tonight will understand more in depth the difference between code switching and code meshing and what those mean linguistically, as well as what those mean in the classroom and in society.
Okay. Well, again, I think our listeners are going to have some questions about how to define code switching, code meshing. Let's start with some definitions, if we could, and then we're going to talk about how we see it sort of manifested, benefits of code meshing, impacts of code switching, especially on the expectations that people of color face when they feel like they have to code switch to sort of conform. And we'll talk more about that. But let's start with what code switching is, what code meshing is, how you would both define them. Dr. Vay?
Sure. Code switching has two definitions, and one of them dovetails with code meshing. So the linguistic understanding of code switching is two or more dialects or languages operating simultaneously or at the same time in one speech act or in one piece of writing. That is to say, if you see two dialects or see two versions of English or two languages in one piece of writing or from one speaker, that's code switching. However, educators think of code switching in a metaphorical sense. They think of code switching as switching from one setting or one context to another. That is to say, I will speak this version of English at home, and then when I leave home and go to work or to school, then I'll speak another version. That is a reductive version of code switching, but that is not the full linguistic definition of code switching. And so educators, in order to compromise in a debate about what should minority speakers of English do when they leave home and go to school, have compromised on the definition of code switching as switching according to context. So I'm against that version of code switching. Now, the linguistic definition, which is two or more languages in one speech act, that's actually the same thing as code meshing. But the reason why we coined the term code meshing is so as not to confuse educators. We didn't want to use code switching to say, oh, let's allow students and, professionals to use two dialects, their home language, as it influences their communication at work or at school, allowing them to use that wherever they are. So we use the term code meshing to say what people naturally bring with them to work, what they naturally bring with them to school in terms of their language repertoire should be used in school and work contexts.
Okay, and so for listeners who have heard discussions led by Gene Demby and many other outstanding journalists and thinkers on NPR and other platforms, they may be thinking, okay, so code switching is when it's sort of one approach in one place or setting, a different approach in another place or setting. And meshing is sort of more of a blending in the same context, whether it's a written piece or spoken or just speech, yes?
Yes.
Okay, that's, again, sort of the distilled version. You want to add to that, Weishan?
No, I think Weishan did a succinct job in saying.
Okay, and so so some of our listeners might start with the question, well, what's the harm? What's the big deal? You know, why is it a bad thing for anyone to have to say, well, I'm going to work, so I'm going to adopt such and such expectation. I'm going to class, so I'm going to write a paper, or I'm going to give a public presentation, a book review, whatever the case may be, with certain expectations of speech and language versus maybe what I'm used to. What's the harm there? Let's start there.
Would you like to take that?
Sure. She leaves the tough ones for me. The harm is that we don't require everyone to do that. And we certainly don't require everyone to do that to the same degree. We require African Americans or Latino Americans off the bat to change their languages or their language habits when they come to school or to work. And to speak very directly, there is a prejudice against African American English. There's a prejudice against Latino English or Spanglish being used at work or at school. And the other problem is that it's very, very difficult to leave or abandon your language habits from home and completely take on another language habit and use that at work or at school without any influence from your home dialect. It's just an erroneous position to adopt and to take. Although many people hold this idea that you can switch from one to another. But when you call people to the carpet and ask them, well, do you see the influences that are coming from home? Do you hear the cadences that your dad used or your mom used come out at school or at work? Then they have to admit, yes, my home language, my accent, my word choice, the syntax, the way in which I speak at home or even write does influence my writing at work and at school. So it's really erroneous to believe that we can leave one language habit and adopt a completely other one in a different context.
And Weishan, just to be more blunt about it, speaking to friends of mine before this program, in preparation for this program, friends of color, they just put it this way. Yeah, I go to work and I have to speak more white. Same kind of thing when I would go to class. It was an expectation of approximating whiteness.
And so it makes me smile because this is something that I often tell Weishan. We're talking about code meshing, but really code meshing is simply a reflection of society. And when you say, I have to speak more white, I have to this, that's the problem. why are we always attaining to another standard that tells us we're less than? Why and why is this being allowed to happen in a place that's supposed to be a haven? School. Our identities are so much wrapped up into who we are, how we speak, our homes. You're telling me to shut that very part of myself off to be more white. And I'm only simply taking the very phrase that you use.
Sure,
but that's what makes this problematic. And it's problematic because it's in the very place where we trust our children to go to be educated. But it's not surprising. And it's interesting, Vershawn will tell you that we had a 10-year argument about this. And he always smiles because he feels like he's victorious because I'm sitting here today with him. But my bigger point is when he challenged me to look at what's really going out there concerning this, I recognize that it's just a larger reflection of systemic things that continue to tell minority people, you don't measure up.
Yeah, if listeners remember, not that long ago, we had a conversation about what the law says about what employers are allowed to say to employees about hair. And an African-American woman who was upset that and was dismissed because she would not straighten her hair, which she said it could take me 2 hours every morning and it's really painful. And your standard of whiteness says I've got to change. I just want to wear my hair where it's natural. And the courts have upheld that form of discipline from employers who usually are white, usually disciplining non-white people of color. And so that calls to mind. So for listeners who are maybe struggling with what they're hearing from our guests, that's another example of how there is this standard of something being right or wrong, but usually the standards are, in this country, coming from a white perspective. So, we're applying that to language, and we're talking about speech expectations. And I want to especially appeal to maybe educators, retired educators, a lot listen to this program, because this book, Other People's English, that our guests are the co-authors of, they aim a lot of this at educators with tips for educators, ideas for how this number one impacts students, but how to make some changes. So if what you're hearing makes you comfortable or uncomfortable, or if you've got thoughts to share on code switching, code meshing, you can call the program. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email us at connections@WXXI.org. Our guests are the co-authors of Other People's English, and they're in town today talking about code meshing, code switching, and these some of the costs. So the book has a section on the costs of code switching, and I just kind of want to be a little specific before we take a couple of phone calls, and then we'll get into maybe the benefits of code meshing and what you'd like to see educators do. In the cost of code switching section, you've got three different costs outlined. Number one is acting white. Number two, increased negative attitudes toward African-American English. And number three, linguistic confusion. Can we take those just kind of point by point, because I think they're important? Number one, acting white. Why is that a cost of code switching?
Acting white is a cost of code switching because it makes minority speakers reimagine themselves as being something other than who they are. And it also privileges white identity. But I want to clarify something about whiteness here. When we say that African Americans or Latino speakers who speak Spanglish have to switch to a different language, some people call that language white language, but I think that that's a mistake. Because I think what we do, and this is part of the problem, is that we have sanitized and made whiteness very pure, as if white people speak standard English or speak professional English and are the keepers of that standard, and they are not. As a matter of fact, if people just open up their ears and hear white speakers speak English on a daily basis, even in educational settings, even in professional settings, they are not speaking standard English overall and on the whole. I have a PhD in English. I hear speakers and read writing from white writers and speakers, and I see all of, from a standard English perspective, and I'm using scare quotes here, all sorts of errors and mistakes. But when minority speakers make those same errors and mistakes, we penalize them way more than the white speakers. Let me give you an example. In the 1980s, and this experiment is quoted in the book by Rusty Barrett, and it's and it has upheld its reliability over the last 20 years. Teachers were given videotapes of black students and Mexican students and white students. And over the black students' pictures, they dubbed English, standard English. When they asked the teachers what they heard the black speakers speaking, the teachers, 80% of them said they heard non-standard English, when in fact, what was dubbed over the video was standard English. When they saw the pictures of white students and what was dubbed over white students was non-standard English, 80% of the teachers said they heard standard English when it was in fact non-standard English. They were equating the race with the language. So race was much more important than whatever the language was that these students were using. And that happens today. We actually have a lot of assumptions and presumptions about how speakers, who they are, about their morality, about all sorts of things that have nothing to do with language simply because of their race. And so that's why it's a cost of acting white, because what minority students are asked to do is A, to buy into a myth that white people speak standard English all the time or are the professional standard bearers. That's a myth right there. And then the second myth is that they have to then become something other than who they are, or dislike or discount their home language and their communication habits in their culture when they go into the professional setting or the work setting. Those are two major things that are a problem with code switching.
Okay, let's grab a phone call and then we'll go into some of the other points that they make on the costs of code switching. This is Bill in Pittsford. Go ahead, Bill.
Oh, good morning. Let me pull over so I make this safe.
Please do. Yes, go ahead.
I've enjoyed listening to the conversation. I grew up in a household where my mother was an English teacher, and she always simplified that there were two differences here, and I am going to clarify my point. If I am a white man, 65 years and older. There is the spoken language in the United States, and it is dialectal whether you're from the South or if you're from the North or you're from Wisconsin. You can tell what part of the country someone's from by their inflections and accents. There is the United States Constitution, which is written in an English language. It is punctuated, so forth, as taught in our public schools. What we teach in our public schools is a written language which should be standardized for everyone coming across, and it is the official language of the United States. If you go to China and you operate a business in China and you do a transaction, it is not official unless it is recorded in the written language of Chinese. And it's the same for a few other countries around the world and the globe that you do international business in. And my question, why is it so hard to differentiate between the written language of what we should be teaching everyone that comes here? The Italian minorities, when they moved here, they learned the English language. When the Irish minorities moved here, they learned the English language. And now we have the Spanish and the black minorities that need to learn the English language. And I'm not talking about the spoken language. It's the written language. So once the underlying standard of the written language is everyone makes written punctuation errors, but the spoken language is different, completely different from the written language. And yes, I agree with your panelists. When our people go home, the Italians go home to their families at night, and the Spanish go home to their families at night, and the blacks go home to their families at night, there's a whole different, I'm going to say this incorrectly, neighborhood spoken language done at the dinner table. So this is a wide realm of discussion, and it's not race. It's not a racial issue, and you can't make it a racial issue. If you do, then it's wrong. It is the textual language that we learn to write in our schools, but how you punctuate that verbally is basically from where you are from.
Hey, Bill, can you stay on the line? Number one, I'm glad you called. I think your view respects the view, reflects the views of a lot of people, and I suspect our guests will. I suspect our guests will have a lot to say. So I'll turn it over to our guests.
You can answer.
I'm sure.
Dr. Bay, go ahead.
There's a lot there. Thank you. I appreciate it. First, let me talk about the race issue. Race is a part of everything. And I understand that in America, many people find that race is a fraught topic. And people believe that race breeds a lot of disagreement. But one of the things that we have to stop telling ourselves is that race doesn't matter. Race matters in everything, all the time, every day. I'm an African-American man. When I get up in the morning and look in the mirror, I see a black man. I know that race matters on a daily basis. And race matters in every topic, and race matters in terms of language. So we can't say that race doesn't matter. And when we talk about languages of Latinos, African-Americans, and other people, we are already talking about a racialized group of individuals. So we can't then say race doesn't matter. It has to, because it's associated and connected with culture and language. The other thing is that it's also, to be fairly direct, it's incorrect to assume that speech and spoken language has no impact on the written language. It absolutely does.
Or are sort of bifurcated and separate.
They're not bifurcated and separate. They're not the same thing, but they influence each other. Think about this. When we write...
But they are separate.
Okay, hold on, Bill. I definitely want you to stay there, Bill, but let's listen to Dr. Bay for a while here.
Okay. When we write, we're taught in school, we're taught in school when we revise to speak the words back to yourself. What did you just write? We ask the students, read that sentence aloud. Then we ask them to find any errors or make any adjustments based upon how they just spoke those words. And I know because I've seen Wyshonda in her writing habits and practice, and definitely in my own, I'm always talking aloud, speaking the words, then I'm writing. And the things that I read have an influence on my vocabulary and on the way that I communicate. So in some countries, let's say in Germany, for instance, there is a distinct written language that's not spoken. In America, we don't have that. In America, there is no separate written English that is separate from what we speak. We speak what we write. And so it's a mistake to think of those things as separate.
Okay. Wyshonda, go ahead.
I just wanted to add, even in the background research that I did, that English is also evolving, and that it's not a stagnant thing, which, playing off of what Vershawn said, it's not, this is what English is. It continues to evolve. And I want to address the race and even class, because I put in my section of the book the word ain't. And I talk about that word because even the notation for the dictionary talks about how old and how long that word has been around, where upper middle class white use the word, and then over time it began to become associated with those who were of lower caste. And to this day, I still get the red ink mark under my Microsoft Word when I type in ain't. Why? And I ask this question. If it's a word we use every day, we all are aware that it exists, it's been around forever, why isn't it still honored in the dictionary? Why isn't it still honored in the English language?
All right, so that's a question that I'd be curious to see Bill answer. What's wrong with ain't? Just as one example, is that an example, Bill, that you think should we give on? How do you feel about that example?
Well, I would take the point of view, this is personal, and we'll pick on Webster, how does Webster get its words? As a professor said, our written language does come from our spoken language. But eventually there's a standard there. So Webster increases, I believe, 4 to 12 words every year based on slang and colloquialism and usage.
Common usage.
And popularity. And then it gets inserted into the dictionary. After it's been there a few years, it is accepted as part of the written language. There are no rules, but I will contend to say that if you are arrested, and I don't care what your race, and I'll say this, the French immigrant that came here who could not speak English learned to speak English. The Italian immigrant that came here learned to speak English. And that filters on down to the whatever the ruling class was. I'm going to pick on New York City. At one time, it was the Irish. And they browbeated the Italians. And it's a step class, true. And race does matter. I wasn't intending on saying that race doesn't matter, but it does. And I'm sorry about that. It's not my generation, I hope. But the written language, if one is arrested, you are arraigned in court and then written up in documents in the English language. And so one needs to learn to read and write the English language. And that was what my mother would contend all the way up to teaching law at Harvard, is that the English language, you write what you say. And what is the term? There's a saying there, mean what you say and write what you mean. Falls into place.
But Bill, so let me just ask you though, because I think you may be talking past our guests here, because when you say, hey, the Italians learned English, hey, the such and such learned English, everyone has to learn English, learn how to write English, you are implying that they are not writing English. And that the argument they're making in the book is they damn well sure are. And our standards are from a very narrow and usually white perspective on what it looks like on the page. And that may be what you're missing, is that your narrow standard is excluding people who are in fact speaking English with different influence and background that may not be the same as yours, but is not less than yours.
Yes. All right. You're correct. The public view of English language is one thing, but what I speak at my Sunday dinner table is a whole different accent and reflection. Is not the written language. I don't speak that way out in the street.
Go ahead.
I would ask Bill if he ever did an experiment and studied whether or not he actually spoke the same words and used the same cadences and the same accent at the dinner table and actually at work or in the streets. I will guarantee you that he does. It's a misperception that people think that because when we're at the dinner table, we might be somewhat more informal than we are at work. But that doesn't mean that we're using a completely different set of words, a completely different set of rhetorical moves when we go to work. That doesn't happen. How I'm speaking here is in large ways how I speak at home. And how I speak at home is in large ways how I speak at work. There is no real difference. Now, there are stylistic differences, small stylistic differences, depending on the genre, depending on the occasion. Sometimes I might be a little louder. Sometimes I might be a little lower. Or a little softer, but I do that at home and at work. I make those kinds of adjustments depending on the rhetorical situation all the time, no matter where I am. So we have to, I think, move away from this idea that we're doing something different at school than we do at home. That's just not, that's not correct.
Hold on. May I go back to my original point, Doctor?
Well,
the point was, you and I grew up in a one country language. I grew up learning English. I don't know a second language. I was not an immigrant. I was born here, raised here. I learned English from public schools and so forth. The people who are coming in to this country now who have a language, when they go home from school at the end of the day and that front door closes and they sit down at the table, they're not speaking English. They're speaking French. They're speaking Italian. They're speaking Spanish. Whatever dialect, across America. That happens every day. There is a home language that's spoken, and these are the accents that we carry. I know when I hear somebody from, I'm going to say Tennessee, speaking English, I know where they're from. I lived down there for a while, and I know the accent. I also know when I hear a weatherman who's from the Northeast, Maine, and his accents are that.
And
there is no standard of language in this country, but we all, behind the front door, when we go home from our businesses, we do speak a different language.
All right, Bill, thank you. Go ahead, Washana.
No, did I just hear you, Bill, say that there is no standard language or there isn't? Write that last comment.
Well, I'm sorry, we don't have Bill, but...
Oh, Bill is gone. Two things came to my mind in his comments, and he really didn't address the ain't thing, and that's big to me. It's big to me because it addresses the fact that English evolves. It's not a stagnant thing, but it addresses the fact that this word that we held for so long is still not given a place of honor that we all, who has not used ain't before? Like, and the other part about the language of people who speak French and Spanish, one thing about that is I've traveled the world. And this goes back to the thing that Vershawn would talk to me about. I'm not telling you to discount, quote unquote, what we call standard English. I'm saying that we have a repertoire of languages and dialects that we can draw from, and using language that's particular to our vernacular is important. And I'm bringing that up with the various languages because I've traveled the world, and when you go to other countries, they're teaching their children from this small. Now we've gotten better at it here in America, but they're able to fluently speak 3, 4, 5 different languages. Those are repertoires that they can draw from when they travel the world. Me and my limitedness of being here, I don't have that repertoire because there was this egocentricness about English and something that we've bought into. You come here, you speak English, you speak this language, forget this or forget that. And I think the argument includes, don't put us in that tunnel anymore, even when it comes to the various different dialects in which we speak or our young people speak. Let that be repertoires from which they themselves can draw from and make use of as well.
Now, listeners, I'm way late for a break and I got to get there, but I've got to squeeze in an email on exactly the subject that sort of dovetails off ain't. So let me get this email, then we'll get a break, then we're coming right back to your phone calls, and I'm already, as a host, feeling like I got no chance to get through half of what I wanted to get through because of all the phone calls and feedback, which just means you should go out to Nazareth College's Art Center tonight, 5:30. Our guests, Dr. Vershawn Ashanti-Young and Washanda Young Rivera, are going to be there talking about their book, Other People's English, Code Meshing, Code Switching, and African-American Literacy. But here's an email from Tepson, who writes, on the code switching question, to what extent does code switching or code meshing allow for nothing more than improper or poor English? For example, my white relative always says, I seen, when the correct usage is, I saw. Are we saying that it is okay to say, I seen, in a professional work environment, since that is how it's said in a home environment that happens to be white? Okay, that comes from Tepson.
Vershawn, that makes me think of what Rusty talked about in the work that he does in terms of, even in studying African-American vernacular, there are pattern ways in which the languages are spoken. And so it is not without its own set of standards. And Vershawn, you can add more to this since Rusty isn't here. But it's not like it's to the wind, do whatever you want, say whatever you want. There isn't a pattern to this. There is organization to various different dialects. I don't know what part you would like to add to that.
Your listeners might want to know that there are 4 authors in the book, and Rusty Barrett is one of the linguists who has also written a section in the book, and he talks about languages and how they are rule governed and so forth. And different regions have different rules regarding the languages that are used and the language that's primarily used in that area. I seen could be, in fact, correct for the region. So linguists don't look at language as being correct or incorrect. Linguists look at language as being grammatical or not grammatical. A language or is grammatical if you understand what it means. So to use the construction I seen, it is grammatical because we understand, just like the example showed, that that is a comparative of I saw. So the person understands it. That means that it's grammatical. Now, if I said I dura, that's not grammatical. That follows no rules. It's nothing. That's gibberish. But if I said I seen, that's okay. That's acceptable at home. And it quite possibly is acceptable at work. If the person has a job, then it shows that it's acceptable. Here's the difference. What we're asking teachers to do and people in society to do is to drop the prejudice against language. Stop getting angry at people for saying I seen. Stop being so disturbed and unnerved about people's idiosyncratic language habits and communicate. Stop being so upset at what is being heard because you believe that it's not standard or you believe that they should change to speak more like you or more like what you believe the standard is, and let's just participate in communication. Code meshing says every linguistic resource that you have is a resource. Language is never a barrier. And this is the problem in school and societies. We want to see how people speak and write as a barrier first. But code meshing says language, whatever way a person writes or speaks, that is never a barrier. The task of school is to help speakers and writers harness all of their linguistic resources and to put those to the most effective ends. And that is for the writer or the speaker to decide, not for the listener. So me as a writer, me as a speaker, I get to decide based upon what I'm learning in school, based upon the resources I'm bringing from home, based upon everything that's within my reach, how I'm going to speak and how I'm going to write. Those are my choices.
Okay, so I know we're going to spend some time with our callers next. Let's get that only break of the hour, and we come right back with the authors of Other People's English, Code Meshing, Code Switching, and African American Literacy right here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, who wouldn't want to take a zip line over the falls of the Genesee River? Well, we've been hearing about this kind of idea for a long time, and it's not a conversation about a zip line, but that's part of it. It's a conversation about Greentopia, the Eco District, the plans for that part of Rochester, and what is and is not happening. We'll get an update next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and we have got to get back to our phone calls. And again, I'll just say, order the book, Other People's English. It's aimed at educators, but it's really aimed at all of us. And even if you don't agree with everything you're hearing, maybe just take some time to sit and think. And I appreciate Bill's phone call and some of the dialogue here because I think it's important. Wendy in Rochester, next. Go ahead, Wendy.
Hi. I just want to put in response to the earlier gentleman talking about people learning standard English. There's as much from when I was studying education, there's as much difficulty in pushing literacy and helping people learn to read and write in areas of the Mountain South where the dialect is very different from the East Coast dialects. And so it isn't accurate to say that just because people who have come here have learned English that this isn't a barrier to literacy for people, that they cannot write the way they think. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to make the analogy, if all you were allowed to do, the reason why people hate to write is because all they're ever allowed to do is to use it to, it's like learning to drive a car and all you're allowed to do is do errands for your mother mm-hmm. with her in the back seat correcting your driving everywhere you go. Mm-hmm. So that's just my comment. Thanks.
Wendy, thank you. Washonda?
I love that, Wendy. Thank you so much. All I could think about, as you said, that is the young people that I work with on a daily basis who are brilliant. who have so much to contribute through their writing, through their ideas. And the moment you mention writing, their faces drop, their shoulders sag. It's like the joy of being able to use this mode of communication. It's burdensome to them. Because I love the analogy. I can only drive with my mother in the back correcting me. Yes, where is that freedom to express my ideas, to express them in a way that allows me to be myself and in which you can understand? And Vershawn and I were talking about this, and I'm not going to dovetail too much off on it, but I love to bring up the point of A.D. Carson, who the graduate from Clemson University, who completed his PhD, and it was done in a 34-song hip-hop album. And we don't think of those type of things being, quote, PhD material. But if you look at his work, he talks about this, I rhyme, this is what I enjoy. When I see things, I see rhythm. And so it's like, why would he not be allowed to take that thing that's almost like I could imagine as he would speak? When I personally, I see things in stories. And so if I'm unable to write a story, I feel stifled. And so I just love the analogy. I think it's a great reminder of what we're talking about in the first place, what this means for our children when they sit in classrooms, the joy of being able to express themselves in words that are real to them and that do not cut off and stifle communication at all.
I want to let Wendy know that I'm going to be using her analogy because it is really an excellent one. And it is an excellent one for teachers to think about. Because it answers a couple questions that I want to point out. A, should we not teach the rules of standard English? We should teach the rules of standard English. But what we should do is use the analogy that Wendy has, right? So when you're driving a car, you know how to do this. You have to have your hands on the steering wheel at 10 and 2 or 9 and 3. You have to have your right foot on the brake and then put it on the clutch. You know some of the structures of where to go and what to do when you drive a car. But you don't need your mother in the back seat telling you what to do all the time. And you don't need to only do that for running errands. So we put students in the driver's seat. We teach them what are the rules here, not just the rules of standard English, but what are the rules and the effects of the grammars that you're bringing to the table, not just what's at school, and then where do you want to go with it? How do we take that for this purpose? How do we turn the car and go for this purpose? And we allow students to be the drivers after we have given parameters, instructions, and so forth. And instead of having the person in the back seat always correcting you or telling you which way to go, we are promoting giving students and speakers and writers agency. And think about this. I've never taught elementary school. I used to teach high school, but Washan used to teach elementary school. And she used to always tell me, she would come home and say, I read to my students, they love this novel. They love this novel. Then she'd read another. They love this novel. Why do they love those stories? Because those stories are expressed in diverse voices told different ways. We can actually pick out passages from an author, right? Let's say an author that has three or four different texts. Pick out a passage from those three or four different texts and say, who's this author? Who's that author? Because we've read them and we know their style. Mm-hmm. We know their resonances. We know their rhetorical moves. And we can say, oh, that's Shakespeare. Oh, this is Toni Morrison. Mm-hmm. Over a corpus of works. This is what we want for our students as well, to be able to say they're individuals, they have their own styles, and what they bring with them in terms of languages from various contexts can aid in any one context. In other words, what they bring from home can aid in their acquisition of literacy and expression of literacy at school.
And you have to just let me extend that for one second. All I keep thinking about, and mom's instructions keep me run into the grocery store. But when I'm given the freedom, I can explore new lands, new neighborhoods, new cities, new towns. And that is what we want to happen with our young people when they come to school.
All right, so let me read an email. And a lot of people thinking about the word ain't this hour. Why, Shonda? This is from Louise. She says, I'd like to know how your guests feel about language as an indication of class rather than race. For better or worse, the use of ain't in conversational or written language indicates a lack of education on the part of the speaker or writer. This is true regardless of the speaker's race. For instance, listening to your speakers on your panel today, it is obvious that they are educated and well-spoken people. I immediately give credence to what they say because it is said well. Teachers should stop being angry about language that is not correct, but are you saying they should stop teaching people how to become well-spoken? To do so is to no longer help people attain the status and respect that being well-spoken confers.
Okay, I need to address that. And this is the thing that, this was the very incident, Vershawn, he can attest to it, I write it in the book, that made me say, okay, we're going to have to do something here. And if you notice, I didn't just say that in standard, quote, English. So I was at a workshop, and there was a white female doctor speaking. And she was talking, and it was about social services. And the audience was a lot of Hispanics and Blacks and things of that nature. And so I don't know, I can't say her motive behind what was happening. But what she was doing was using a whole lot of ain'ts, and the audience can't see me, but you can see, and punctuating with a head nod here and this or that. And I'm looking around the room, and everyone was loving it. But I was saying to myself, I said, I know. And I'm using ain't. And that's probably why I harp on it so much in the book, because this doctor, this white female doctor, was using that word in her speech. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm looking around. And Vershawn can attest, I sent him a text. And I said, I know what you're talking about. Because if that would be me up there, same degree, everything, how would they be thinking about me punctuating my head using the word ain't, even though I have the same degree? And I know, I know that the reception would not have been the same. It would not have been the same. And that was the catalyst that made me say, you're right, there's a different standard. There's a different standard, and we have to start doing something about this. Thus again, action. It's not enough to just be aware. What is the action we will now begin to take?
And the standard that I used to always point out to her is that there was a different attitude about how white people would speak, even if they would use Black vernacular. And the consequences for them would be much different for an African American using Black vernacular. But I want to point out to the person that wrote the email is that part of the reason why we have credibility on this show right now is not because we're using standard English. We are using standard English, but you will note that we've both, Waishonda and I have both used African American English here today throughout almost all of this conversation.
You've code meshed?
We have code meshed. And this is one of the things that that people should realize, that code meshing is natural. It's a habit that everybody, whether you have a PhD or not, does. And here's the thing about having a PhD. My African-American English is not going to sound the same as someone's African-American English who does not have a PhD. I don't go home and all of a sudden become, I would say, gangster. That's not me, right? I still use African-American English, but it's informed now by my having a PhD in English. Mm-hmm. So my point here is to say, you never lose yourself. You never lose your language, no matter what other standard of education you have. And those things become blended, and that is what we should be promoting, that blended resourcefulness for language use.
And Louise, I appreciate the email. I'll give you an easy example of someone who comes to mind for me, who is someone who code meshes seamlessly and is read widely, and that's Ta-Nehisi Coates, who both in speech and in writing, that goes back to Bill's point, it's not just in Coates' speech, it's in his writing that you see meshing on every paragraph, which goes back to the heart of this book. And to Louise's point about ain't, I don't know if she thinks that I'm an educated person, but I use ain't, you know, sometimes for effect. I don't always say is not, and I don't think it confers lower class, but I'm not penalized for it when I use it. You know, like when my six-year-old says, I want one more fig bar, and I say, ain't happening. You know, the people around me don't sit and look around and say, wait, I thought you were educated. There is a different standard in play here that Wyshonda is bringing up in her example that I think is important to consider. So Louise, Bill, and so many other phone calls and emails, we couldn't get through any nearly all of them, but look up the book. It's called Other People's English, Code Meshing, Code Switching, and African-American Literacy. Really interesting stuff for educators to think about and for all of us to think about, but a lot more that you can hear tonight. 5:30 tonight, free and open to the public, the Nazareth College Arts Center. Their lecture is going to be there, and you're going to hear a lot more from them. So wish we had more time, but thank you to both of you for being here. Really appreciate both of you being here.
You're welcome, and thank you for having us.
All right, short break, more connections coming up.